recognize this, the ethics of face tagging, mobile face tagging. We showed that video to open it up because I guess the main or the most popular adjective that people use to when describing facial recognition technology is creepy. So that's sort of the theme. We debated on whether or not we wanted to call this panel creepy tech. But yeah, so we played creep as well at the beginning.
Your hosts for this this hour.
My name is Brian Nunez. I work for Witness. It's a human rights organization, and we work with human rights activists on the ground, equipping and training them with video technology so that they can use it in their advocacy campaigns.
And I'm Harlow Holmes. I'm a developer and, I guess, head of metadata at Guardian Project, and we are an app development shop that works with a lot of do-gooder organizations, so human rights defenders, NGOs, journalist organizations, and the like, who are interested in working with media, but in a very, very secure way.
So we wanted to start out with an overview of the technology around facial recognition and face detection, and I think the two terms are used interchangeably, but we want to make sure that people understand that they're not exactly the same thing.
Yeah, so with facial face detection, which you see on the left-hand side, it's usually like for the benefit of the device that you're using. So if you're going to take a picture, it might, you know, find eyes, nose, and mouth in, you know, the right proportion in order to help you in like autofocusing, or if you take a, you know, triggering the flash when someone smiled, or finding points where, you know, someone has, you've taken a picture and their eyes are closed or something, and so you might want to retake it. So these are things that are done for the benefit of the device in order to aid in picture taking, not necessarily facial recognition, which is more for the benefit of a larger infrastructure altogether.
Right. I think that just the key distinction is that facial recognition remembers information, whereas face detection does not. And so that's a, sort of the key differentiator as we start to talk about the ethics of facial recognition.
Yep. So facial recognition is, I like to think of, as a system encompassing hardware, software, and infrastructures, and these can be political infrastructures, economic infrastructures, social infrastructures, and every place in the Venn diagram where those things intersect. So on the hardware level, you know, it's kind of easy to think of. You've got your computers, you've got your cameras, and they're all running software that, you know, that aid in the facial recognition. Now that, of course, facial recognition is a practice that really emerged in the late 80s, or really got on its feet in the late 80s, but nowadays, you know, decades later, now that we have mobile devices, you don't necessarily have to be linked to a computer. All of these things can be, like, images can be captured on a device, analyzed in the cloud, and, you know, interfacing with databases and sending results back to the person who's querying. Go ahead. In terms of software, next. Software can represent a billion different things. On the far right, that's actually a weird picture, screen capture of this software package called Morris, which is Mobile Offender Recognition and Information System, which pretty much, you know, looks at pictures of perps, matches them up in a, you know, broader database that's usually localized to like a certain district. The other picture that's really weird, that gray picture, is a representation of what are called eigenfaces. Okay, so this is a little bit of a technical background. The eigenface, hold on one second as I pull up my notes. The process of facial recognition has a few key components, but the most important one that we're going to talk about today revolves around creating and analyzing eigenfaces. Okay, so an eigenface is a mathematical construct. It's a product that is the result of when a photograph of a face is analyzed for principal component and analyzed via principal component analysis, which is statistical method. So it rests on the principle that, you know, human faces are all similar, and every human face is kind of modular, meaning that, you know, any one person's face shares a set of characteristics that are common throughout the entire human race. And so in order to successfully recognize a face, you compare it to a larger set of images, of collected images of other people's faces. And of course, the face is recognized when, you know, you're able to find the one that has the least statistical derivation. So this large set of images that you scroll through in order to find your match is called the training images. And so those have to come from somewhere, naturally. So any system using facial recognition draws from a store of such training faces that it's gathered over time. They accumulate in a database. So the local police will have a database containing faces of known criminals in the area. You, using an app that uses like the face.com API or Butyl or something like that, we'll talk about these in greater depth later, that actually uses a set of eigenfaces based off of your social network. What else? And so even like if you have the face unlock feature on your phone, does anyone have that? It's on Android devices running Ice Cream Sandwich. It's actually really cool. My phone is locked, and it turns on the camera immediately. And so when I put my face in front of it, it compares that to what it knows of my face in order to unlock it. This is the same thing. It has a collection of eigenfaces based on me that live in my phone that tells it, you know, open sesame when I'm in front of the camera. So what's interesting about this is that at the outset of facial recognition technology in the 80s, in the late 80s, you can imagine that the pool of available eigenfaces, these training faces, was pretty small, limited to, you know, what the scientists and researchers collected and put into their database. It's going to be limited. So fast forward another two decades to where we are now, and with, you know, the provision of social networks, with the fact that Facebook and Flickr have the largest image libraries in the world that total in the hundreds of billions of images, the number of eigenfaces has grown exponentially. It's pretty interesting. So the infrastructure, these are efforts that, it's a fine order. I actually had more up there in that slide, but I'll work around it. So various infrastructures, when you take a look at them, it's kind of thrilling to see how the technology has pervaded so many aspects of life nowadays. So from individual use, like the phone example with the face unlock that I told you about, to the highest government bureaucracies. The FBI, Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security, all use now, they used to be fragmented, but now it's all centralized database system called Next Generation Identification, which is used to expedite the use of facial recognition and some other stuff like, you know, fingerprints, retinal scans, stuff like that, in law enforcement. And so a substantial infrastructural support for programs like these are seen in like the very controversial Secure Communities Initiative, which we're going to talk about later. And as you see, it's also worked itself into the commercial sector, into advertising, and even into our own phones. Oh my God. What do we think about this? You've come a long way, baby.
I just want to hold on to the picture of Doug Henning for a second.
Okay, so we're going to talk about the timeline of this technology. And I like to say, even though this is kind of my own creation here, I say that we got started with this, really, in 1977 with Michel Foucault and his works on biopower. This was actually from a series of books that he wrote from 77 to 80 about biopower. And so what that is, it's an interesting concept. Even though facial recognition, as we're talking about it today, was not on the man's radar, Foucault definitely presaged the current situation that we're facing. So the theory is interesting, if not Orwellian. you know, the state with like a capital S seeks to exert control over individual citizens and uses the body as a site for control. This is where it collects biometric data, like the fingerprints, the face, this retinal scan. And all of these are the manifestations of this control. So the very fact that this has become ingrained in our day-to-day life in various ways, Foucault would say, is a way that the state is preparing us to accept and internalize this control. Now, you can take this theory with a grain of salt, take it or leave it if you want, but it is interesting to think about how it has become normal, it has become banal, and as it does, we're tacitly giving our consent to this form of governance. In the 1980s, CCTV, the efforts of CCTV in London really, really start to ramp up, and we all know London is really infamous for their use of CCTV to monitor activity in their streets. Although the program got started in like the 60s, it wasn't until the 80s when they started actually making use of that data in, you know, a more real-time way. In 1993, a paper or a series of papers were released primarily out of MIT about the benefits of facial recognition's two main ways of going about it. One is templating, and the other one is called feature gathering or gallery gathering. So the template matching is generated from, you know, a single image of a face where the salient or prominent features are mapped to a two-dimensional array of intensity values. And these can be mathematically operated on and compared to, you know, the standard facial template. And so the variation of intensities reveals a match. However, feature detection by gallery is another approach where galleries of a certain subject contain several images of one person. Usually from different angles, under varying lighting conditions, it makes it a lot more elastic. And so as a new image is acquired and added to the gallery, a similarity matrix is generated from all of the previously existing images. And so in the early 90s, researchers discovered that while, you know, this more elastic gallery approach was about 10% more effective than the template approach, the very, very fact that in 1993, it was like so hard to push all of the gallery images over, you know, a network and get information from a database and things like that, restricted how they used facial recognition technology. So they started relying more on the template view. And it wasn't until, you know, Moore's Law, whatever, increases in technology and our capabilities, that not only did our priorities change in the way that facial recognition is done, but that increased capability changed the way that it was worked into legislation, the way that it's worked into the, you know, law enforcement. We'll get into this when we talk really a lot about secure communities. 2001.
Yeah, so we all know what happened in 2001. And that was sort of, I guess, the turning point in some ways about like how the world's focus sort of shifted to how can we make ourselves more secure. And that also manifested itself in facial recognition technology, a big push from the U.S. government as well as other places to get or to advance facial recognition technology. And they did a big test of it at the 2001 Super Bowl, in which they set up a prototype facial recognition system to scan basically everyone who came to the Super Bowl that year in Tampa. And I'm not exactly sure what the results were. Some people say that there were 19 people arrested. Some people say that there were no people arrested.
I think there were 19 people found? I don't think they arrested all
okay.
of them.
All right. Yeah, so this is also ties into the fact that the technology wasn't ready yet, and I think we're going to argue as well that it's still a little sketchy. And then it starts to...
my favorite movie.
Yeah, it starts to creep into mainstream culture, 2005.
2005, just put this on a little blip for you guys to put in the back of your head, which is the year that Facebook kind of unleashed itself on, you know, all or a greater number of college campuses, not just Harvard, and it started to, you know, get popular and become like the new thing. Lots of photos got uploaded.
2007. So this is sort of like where we start to see where it sort of moves from the general creepiness of face detection to what are the real implications of having a lot of people's faces accessible and online. What you're looking at is an image of it's not automatic facial recognition, it's really crowdsourced facial recognition, and I think that's also something to think about, which is this idea that that governments are beginning to use the idea of crowdsourcing to identify people it thinks are threats to it. So this is from the Green Revolution of 2007, and it's a crowdsourced image of quote-unquote protesters or dissidents with the call to identify the people for the purposes of reporting them to the government.
'08 to 2009 was the beginning of secure communities. And so this is such an interesting part, I think, of history. It comes, well, there's two things worth noting here. First off, the technology that undergirds secure communities came out of a collaboration with the FBI, Department of Defense, and Department of Homeland Security, and Lockheed Martin, who provided the technological infrastructure. And so for those of you who are not familiar with secure communities, it was an initiative in order to increase cooperation between these various departments within the government, because prior to this initiative, their databases didn't necessarily sync up. So, you know, FBI would have its own database, Homeland Security has its other database, and when you run a search on, you know, someone that you've picked up for some violation, you don't necessarily receive the complete results because these two databases are not talking to one another. So what they did was they created with Lockheed Martin a system for normalizing the databases so that they are interoperable. Also, increased work on transparency and using not only the template view but the gallery view, which we had discussed earlier. So, what's interesting about secure communities, or for an example, at a routine or at a traffic stop, if someone is violating local traffic laws, they're being stopped by a police officer, and they can be looked up within this database. And so, if there is a match on this person by their face, or it's usually done first by the face because that's the least intrusive piece of data to take. It queries these databases, usually not only looking for prior arrest history or an outstanding warrant or something like that, but also looking at this person's immigration status, whether or not they're on a terrorist watch list or something like that. That has its own benefits as well. But the very fact that the relatively small offense of a traffic violation reaches all the way up to the highest levels of our government security and then comes down is viewed by a lot of people to be kind of a creepy and Orwellian a misuse of power. To the point where, if it is someone who's in the country illegally, automatically the immigration is notified, and the next visit that person receives, from their holding cell, it's not a lawyer, but it's usually the ICE man. And so a lot of, because, this was causing a lot of disruption within communities, it was kind of trampling on the trust that the local police force had built up with their communities or whatever, a lot of governments or local governments opted to, you know, opt out of secure communities. But this was really, really not in order, opting out in the terms of service of secure communities, it was not actually an option to opt out. So a government could refuse to participate in secure communities, but still the data that they had captured and sent over the wire at this routine traffic stop or whatever still made its way to the Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah, and there's also a lot of money flowing from the U.S., the federal government to local police departments as an incentive to adopt these technologies.
I have one more. Oh, there was one more thing I wanted to say. Another interesting part about secure communities, and this is actually from the researcher Travis Hall, a contemporary of mine at NYU, is that secure communities also involve something called wrap back, which means that the same database that holds, you know, criminal records from local precincts also holds, you know, records for people who are just applying, you know, for immigration status. But it also contains the necessary data that you'd offer as, like, for instance, a lawyer taking the bar or something like that. So in cases where, you know, you have an employer who wants to be notified that, you know, you have, committed a crime or something like that, that same database that your employer would use, or, you know, the bar association would use to vet you as you're taking the bar, those kind of things, are linked to the same database. So not only one can conceive that a project like Secure Communities casts a pall of criminalization on the general populace, and this was kind of the first time that we've seen this.
Right. So this is also one of the major themes. It's not just the technology is advancing. It's the fact that all of these databases and information stores are becoming networked and cross-referentiated. In 2010, we start to see the Arab Spring, and this is important not just because they used some of the same techniques that the Iranian government used in 2007, but it's also a proliferation of a lot of imagery and video shot on mobile phones, which then gives, it provides a viewpoint of what's happening on the ground, but it also puts a lot of people at risk in terms of being able to identify individuals from stills, from the videos, from still images. And this is sort of where, at least us at Witness, we start to feel that there needs to be a conversation and a need to address some of these security issues with online videos and images. And in 2011, there were a couple of riots that happened. One was in London, and then one happened in Vancouver, both of which were covered extensively using mobile phone cameras and published and distributed via social media. The interesting thing about both of these situations were that so-called web vigilante efforts were organized by members of the public using online photos and videos posted to Facebook and Flickr. And in the case of the London riots, these web vigilantes also took advantage of a new technology called Face.com, and which provided an API with which to analyze online photos. So the interesting thing here is that whereas earlier in the timeline, as Harlow described, it was facial recognition and database cross-referencing was something that governments could do. You needed a lot of resources. The databases were hard to get to, hard to get access to. It was hard to create an index or a gallery. By 2011, there are publicly available APIs, and a huge store of photos, Facebook and Flickr, that you could just run these technologies against. So it becomes a lot easier to make a facial recognition system sort of in your home. So.
And here we go down the rabbit hole. So, as Brian has just mentioned, the API opens up a lot of doors in terms of taking, you know, one data point, matching it up with as many others as you like in order to get these new pictures about the people involved. Renonymization is a term that was kind of coined recently, meaning to discover using data from an anonymized data set, a data set from which the explicit identifying data has been removed, which specific individuals generated the data. And so when you mash that, or when you put that together with facial recognition as kind of this entryway into, you know, the various data that you also might drip as part of your day-to-day existence in technical media, that your image is used as a unique ID in a database query used to join other tables in a database. At this point, we're calling out Butyl, Facebook, Face.com, and stuff like that for actually, you know, democratizing the way that these things are done.
Yeah, as Alessandra Acquisti, which we referenced liberally in this presentation, he did a study at Carnegie Mellon University in which he was able to use facial recognition technology to take a sample of random students and match them against their Facebook profiles, and then from the names that he was able to get, he was able to identify like a third or so of them, and from there, using publicly identifiable or publicly accessible information, he was able to guess a large amount of the social security numbers, or at least the last five numbers of their social security numbers. That's sort of an example of like how, as Harlow was saying, facial recognition sort of connects the dots between these disparate areas of anonymous data, in the sense that given as individual pieces, you can't really tell who the data belongs to, but you put them together, and facial recognition is a way to sort of tie everything together. You get a more substantive profile of an individual. So these applications and platforms are using this technology, I mean, it's not so much that we're really calling them out, but they're examples of what's happening out there in terms of facial recognition, and this is sort of how they're selling it to us.
Go, internet, go.
Come on. So we've seen the sort of creepy dystopian perspective with Minority Report, and this one should be like the happy, look how fantastic everything is. When I fall, when I'm bested, you call. You're my only, you're my all. Isn't it amazing?
And you know, and you know. So kiss me for a while. All right.
apparently it also makes you really attractive and cool.
Yeah, it kind of actually, like, given the weather and the taco trucks and all that stuff, it seems like it was made for this very event. I see myself in there. Yeah. So what? That's the question. I don't know. How do we feel about this?
Yeah, so this is sort of where...
Oh, actually, hold on one moment. We're going to open it up for questions very, very shortly. We have one more thing. But yeah.
Yeah, so the problem is that we don't have a whole lot in place right now in terms of regulation, liability, legal resource, and the ability to sort of control how you interact with this ecosystem of data and technology. There exists some standards for self-regulation, but I think that, as we mentioned before, as this technology becomes more accessible to people, it becomes harder and harder to self-regulate. So at some point, we're going to have to address the privacy issues of facial recognition. And that we've started in the sense that the FTC commissioned a study last year and had a conference about how what are the privacy implications of facial recognition, and sort of did a request for submissions on how to address the issue. And so I just wanted to go through some quick examples of how things have gone wrong, or what, how it's being used. So also last year, a man in Massachusetts had his driver's license revoked almost sort of randomly. He got a letter in the mail saying that his license had been suspended because he was there was a warrant out for his arrest. And that was because the state of Massachusetts routinely runs driver's license photos against a database of people who have warrants. And
we all know how clear and precise a driver's license photo is.
Right.
It's great.
In the end, it took him 10 days to get his driver's license back. And at the end, we're kind of running short on time, so I'm just going to fast forward. We talked about the London riots. It's also being used in Afghanistan. I think is it 1 in 6, maybe, adult males have biometric information in the military databases. We talked about secure communities. We're going to skip that. So this sort of is the crux of why we're worried about the unregulated and sort of not well thought out use of facial recognition. This was the response that the man in Massachusetts got from the DMV. A representative from the DMV, which is basically, you know, tough shit. It happens. And there needs to be a better understanding, not just amongst us, the people in this room, and the general public, but I think it's really an important thing that governments understand that sort of the automation of their work doesn't necessarily make for a better and more efficient way to either catch criminals or to make people obey the law. With the increased volume and automation, you're also getting a lot more false positives. And it's only working in that one direction. It's not working in the opposite. So your recourse out of that situation doesn't have the same volume and level of automation that getting stuck into that rabbit hole does. So everyone thinks that it's creepy, and I just wanted to show that it's showing up in all of the reviews of facial technology applications. The word creepy comes up. What do we need to do? I think that there have been responses from the companies, some of which we profiled here, and I think they're aware of the issue. The reality is facial recognition isn't going away anytime soon. It's going to happen, and companies are trying to address it. The FTC study that I mentioned earlier, one of the responses from Facebook sort of outlined this idea that the principles need to exist in the first place. And this is sort of referring to this whole idea of privacy by design. So even before the technology is made, you need to come at it from this idea that let's address privacy at the outset of the conceptualization of the product, rather than bolting it on at the end. And that people need to be given a choice to opt out. And that should... And that privacy should be the default setting rather than the opt-out version, in the sense that if you want to use facial recognition technology in your social networks or in your mobile applications, that should be a choice that you make rather than one that the technology companies make for you in advance and then tell you about it later. And that all of this, all of the processes that lead to the development of these technologies need to be open and transparent. So, sort of the opposite of what Facebook does, which is tell you that they change their privacy policies after they've already done it. So let's try and keep going. So there are a couple things that we wanted to cover as well, going back to the initial difference between face detection and facial recognition. So the thing to remember is that applications that don't remember anything, such as face detection, they're probably okay. I don't know if for those of you who were here earlier and I was playing a video of myself interacting with that interactive billboard. I think it's out in the hallway if you want to check it out later. It detects your face, and to the extent that it just knows that there's a face in the video, it's fine, as long as it doesn't remember it. What becomes more problematic is as this information becomes... Well, the application remembers the information and then stores that face print in a database that can be used later. And that's full facial recognition. And the problem with that is that different applications can access those databases, and there needs to be control over how and when those people and applications can access what's essentially uniquely identifiable information about individuals. So, sorry, I keep going back to this whole idea of creepiness.
All right, so let's...
Wait, sorry, I made a mistake with the Prezi. So we do want to talk about it, but I also... Yes, we do want to talk about it, and I wanted to show the application.
Let's get some questions.
All right.
Yeah, let's open up the floor to questions. If you'd like to, you guys can come up to the mic in the center, just so we can update your voices on the podcast.
They're podcasting, so.
Yeah, the issue of privacy in the United States, at least, has been addressed by the Fourth Amendment.
Yes.
And it does not, it follows the individual. So, as a private citizen, I have a reasonable expectation of privacy that my presence, my visual presence, cannot be commercialized. And that has been already has been already litigated to the point that a still picture taken of me in public cannot be used for commercial purposes as a private individual. Mm-hmm. I'm not a public individual.
Right.
And the thing that I see here is that a lot of the technology is ignoring that caveat that as a public, the difference between a public and a private individual. It does not matter whether I'm in public or not. It is the fact that I'm a private individual that cannot be used to commercialize the applications. And I think part of the thing that you're saying, let's go from here, is that we're not looking back as technologists to keep that concept in mind, that as private individuals, if you take a video of me walking across the street, you cannot recognize my face, you cannot commercialize that face by selling it to a third party or anything like that. And that needs to be addressed in forums like this and in the development of technology. And, you know, that is where we're at right now. If, you know, Facebook needs to be sued, you know, to bring that up, I think that's where self-regulation comes in. Mm-hmm. You know, the difference between public individuals and private individuals, and that's where privacy lies.
Right.
Yeah, I think that it's beyond like the scope of self-regulation at this point. And I think the FTC study sort of hints at that, at hopefully government attention on how facial recognition is used. The problem is that it's easy to do at a distance, and that it's becoming more accessible for people to sort of roll their own face recognition technologies.
Hi, I'm a graduate student at NYU and at ITP, and I think one of your co-collaborators was Nathan Freitas.
Yes.
And he showed us how we could use it. We took a class called Social Activism Using Mobile Technology,
yes,
and how powerful it is to be able to obscure the faces of people in a protest or something like that, where you don't want the state to be able, mm-hmm, to then punish them for being at a rally or something like that. And I was wondering if you already touched on it, or if you could tell us more about it, and also, is it being developed for the iPhone?
Okay. We are, along with Nathan Freitas, our fearless leader and the guy who signs my paychecks, we're representing the team that developed ObscuraCam, which is an app on the Android market. And actually, Brian is... the crux of ObscuraCam is that it allows you to take a picture, redact regions within it, and then wipe its metadata, so when it's shared, it's unhinged, or it's delinked from, you know, the context around its production. And so that's a way that, you know, if something is in the image that you'd want to protect that you don't think people should see, you can take full control over it. We've actually started doing some testing with video as well. As you can see there in our camera, that's me and Nathan testing out the latest build with video.
Yeah, so another important theme is that technology is neither good nor bad nor neutral.
Right.
It really is dependent on how you use it. So we're definitely not advocating. We're not Luddites, obviously. I think an important thing to think about is like, how can we use technology sort of in the service of individual liberty and privacy, not necessarily as a way to directly combat the Facebooks and the face.coms,
right,
of the world,
right,
but as a way to have choice, right? So people need to have some agency around how their individual data and in this case faces are used in the systems that we upload these images and videos to.
Really quickly, though, about your iPhone question, we currently do not have an iPhone version, but it is in the works. We're definitely investigating it. Just as a little side blip, I will say that it's not necessarily about the development of the app, but it's about the licensing of, you know, certain libraries, for instance, within the app that make it incompatible with iTunes distribution, you know, terms of service. So,
right,
like, Yeah, they're kind of hostile to GPL licenses.
Yeah, so ObscureCam is a completely open source project, and the idea is that we're actually not interested in making the ObscureCam as an app. We are interested in making the features of the ObscureCam and the concepts behind it accessible to both not just the public, but also to technology companies. We would love nothing better than to have Instagram put in automatic facial detection and redaction filters into their app, or for Samsung or Apple to put automatic face detection and redaction into their cameras. Mm-hmm. If we can get that to happen, then that's a win for us.
Yes.
We don't want to make the app. We want other people to use the technologies. And even if other people make better technologies, that would be great as well.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Can you tell us more about the London vigilante incident? The London vigilante incident, if you can tell us more about it. Did they actually use Face.com, or did they create their own software? And were they successful in the end in identifying people?
No. Well, they did use Face.com. They were not successful. Actually, that was one of the things that came up. And sort of to Face.com's credit, they only allow you to index your own friends on Facebook. So in an interview with someone from Face.com about that specific incident, it would be really hard for someone to try and use the Face.com API to both crowdsource an application to identify random people who are outside of your Facebook friends. The problem isn't so much that that technology companies aren't putting in some of these privacy and safety features into their APIs. The problem is that the whole data set exists somewhere, and someone needs to think about how to implement ways in which Facebook wouldn't be able to do it. If Facebook wanted to, there's really nothing stopping them from doing if they already have
a mass
index of everyone's face recognition profile.
Yes, and also in the Face.com example, that only that check on the privacy only corresponds to instances where you're using the Facebook API. So images from other sources are not bound by Facebook's terms of service.
Yeah, so that you can use other sources of photos rather than Facebook. But the other thing that sort of came out from the London riot vigilante action was that there were a lot of false positives from the use of the technology. So it's getting there, and I think it was Eric Schmidt from Google who said that it's scarily accurate, but I think it's mostly scary at this point. Dan.
Hi. It's a great talk, guys. It's really interesting. I actually wanted to mention a project that I'm blanking on the name of it, but I bet you guys know what it is.
Would you actually tilt the microphone?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
There's a project that I'm blanking on the name of it, but I think you guys might know what it is. I think it was in London. A guy put an LED on his hat or something, and it was made this halo of invisibility to the CCTV cameras. What is that project? I was trying to remember the name of it.
I don't remember it off the top of my head either, but that's actually another, if we had more time, I definitely would have liked to talk about the methods of hiding yourself from having your image taken against your will. That being one of them, of course, like, you know, a blinding light shining at a camera, of course, you know, that will block it out. But also, there was a similar project also from London where people pretty much applied like razzle-dazzle makeup to their face.
Yeah, there's a Dazzle CV, which was also another ITP project.
I actually had a different question, though. It was something that occurred to me, and I was trying to remember the name of it. I feel like the problem with the privacy problem is more of a cultural problem, at least here in America. It's not so much the lack of privacy controls; it's a lack of forethought or understanding of the meaning of the controls on the part of the public. And I wonder if the false positive numbers that are out there might help with some kind of advocacy. Are there widely known numbers about false positives? I know it's kind of a tricky thing to get at.
We just have 5 minutes.
Okay. In terms of the false positives, I think at this point, unfortunately, there aren't too many cases that, like, you know, get considerable amount of attention in the press, like the one that Brian had mentioned with the DMV mix-up. Usually when you're getting... And the reason for this, I think, is because... These cases usually, like, you know, come out of the law enforcement context where they tend to be a little bit more mum about their figures. So unless we do, you know, become aware of more cases where this is actually reaching the general population rather than just, like, you know, this cordoned off to the side criminal element, then we'll have more grounds for more fodder for an advocacy.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add, like, that one of the other principles that that people are trying to advocate in terms of the false positive issue is that a lot of law enforcement agencies aren't deleting the false positives.
Right.
They keep all that data. So it's almost like if you've been proven innocent, they still want to keep that data. So they'll have it next time they think you've
just
done something. Just in case.
Okay.
So what should happen is that if you're a false positive, all of that should go away and you should start fresh as though you've never been in the system.
Yes. Come on forward.
Great. I have a question in a similar vein to the bright light shining at the camera. Has there been any research on how to subvert these algorithms in the sense that, let's say I have a picture I'm uploading to Facebook, maybe I can apply a filter that moves my eyes around or, you know, makes my nose bigger or whatever. Is there anything like that, any work people are doing? And I guess the corollary to that is it possible to subvert the algorithm but not people? Like, is there a way where I could change my image in a way that you would recognize me but these algorithms wouldn't?
Yeah, so we mentioned, like, in passing, this project called Dazzle CV. And it was a study done by Harvey, I think his last name is, and I forget his first name, but he also he went to school at the program that we're from, and it's face paint to defeat face recognition algorithms, and it's not sort of like the thing that you would imagine. It really kind of looks like a mixture between, like, Fall Out Boy haircuts and Insane Clown Posse makeup. That seems to mess up face recognition systems.
Unfortunately, you probably don't want that on your Facebook wall because it looks kind of weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's actually a good question for research, though. I would be interested in other ways to, like, tweak an image, you know, just a little bit in order to throw it off. I mean, I'm sure that is possible, but whether or not it's possible without actually, like, transforming the image so much as to make someone unrecognizable, I'm not 100% sure. But that's a good thing to look into.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
At the beginning, you showed the solution Intel AIM, and we are from VisaPix, the German competitor of this solution. And we have a privacy license for this as the only company. Do you have any experience with this kind of technology in the retail market in the US?
Hmm.
face detection?
Is there...
Face detection rather than facial recognition?
Face detection.
I'm sorry, okay, what was the question exactly, though, about it?
Whether you have experience with the use of this face detection here in the U.S.?
Do we have experience with the use of...
Is it common, or is it...
Yes. I mean, well, in terms of face detection, which is, you know, separate from what we've been talking about so far, facial recognition, it is common in the United States. I mean, just in terms of, like, the basic hardware level where...
Most cameras will do it.
Yes, exactly, where it's automatically in cameras for, you know, auto-detect.
Most mobile phone cameras do it. The latest update to iOS 5 added face detection.
For what?
Oh, for research solutions. Or resale.
Retail solutions. We're starting out, I guess, kind of slowly, but I believe that's one of the projects worked on by a group called PitPat, recently acquired by Google. They are a lab that uses face detection and, like, pattern recognition like this in order to, you know, create an API that can be used in the retail sphere, in the, you know, app market, stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't think it's not that common. Like, the video that we showed at the beginning is sort of, it's a very early prototype. We're a little ways out from the Minority Report scenario. Who knows if it's going to take off? I do think that there's sort of an evolutionary survival mechanism that we all have that makes us think that this stuff is creepy to the point where we probably, I don't know, this is conjecture on my part, but I feel like people don't want that level of interaction with advertising in which suggestions are made to you based on what it thinks you look like. Although interacting with that advertising screen out there, they were pretty right on when it tried to sell me some potato chips.
Yeah, I can see myself becoming really, really insulted by, like, stuff that they might try to sell to me. But that's a discussion for another day when we've all had our experience with these technologies and we can come back and talk about, you know, where it went wrong and where it went right. And so that said, I believe our time is up.
Yes.
So we want to thank you very, very much for coming out today. And if you tweet at us, if you have any more questions or comments or whatever, we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, and we'll stick around for a few minutes to demo the ObscuraCam app for those of you who want to check it out. Thank you.
Thanks.